I think when this was first planned, Ruth asked me if I wanted to talk. And give a lecture. And I said, well, no, I'd rather read. And she said, well, I hope you talk a little. I guess the answer to that's trying to stop me, but does this work?
That's for recording, wasn't
it? It's operating now?
Yes.
Oh. Oh, it's not a public address system. I couldn't hear myself out there at the rebound. Like a decreasing number of poets, at one time I would have said, like most poets, like a decreasing number of poets, I don't believe that a great deal of the sort of thing that is nowadays said about poetry, the present school of technical and criticism which flourishes in America, particularly in the academic world, is very effective. Those of you who heard Bill Williams a few weeks ago, I don't know how many of you were taken in by some of the things Bill said, but of course a good deal of the stuff that he said about his own verse was deliberate hoax. Bill is not, in the first place, I remember he said on the platform, he said, well, there I was, just a simple country doctor. amongst all those English professors, I was completely out of my depth. Well, Bill reads five or six languages, the classical languages, and Spanish and French, Italian, German, because he's a physician, so that he has some of this. He naturally knew German and was taught German and Latin. He's a pretty good Greek scholar. He has a translation of Theocritus in his last book. And he has, oh, I don't know how many years of education, both. So he has a general cultural education before a doctor's, before an M.D. And a great deal of graduate work in Europe as an M.D., so that this good old Bill, the poem splitter, is strictly for the rubes. I mean, it just isn't true. He's done this all his life. And, of course, the writer does this, unless he's a writer like John Crow Ransom or Alan Tate or William Empson. He does this to protect himself, by and large. Protect himself from the intrusion of people who are just going to disturb him and mix him up and confuse the issue, and to whom it will be impossible to explain what he's talking about anyway, so you follow up. And a man whom I have considerable respect for, who's a literary wheelbarrow pusher of the very first class, is Dickens is his name, Lawrence Hart, who around San Francisco and the Bay Area for many years has taught poetry, has produced a number of very significant poets. He's evolved this all to a system with a whole lingo of its own. What it all amounts to is that Larry is very much in love with his wife, Jean McGahee, who's a very good poet, and he teaches everybody to write like his wife, and all this gobbledygook that he hands out doesn't really mean anything. The real effect comes from knowing Jean, reading her poetry, and associating with the two of them, sitting in their classes and talking. So I, but it's really quite a lingo. And every once in a while, he wants me to write a statement for some little magazine he's publishing or something. And how I write, send him one of my worksheets. So, well, my worksheets all go to Harvard. And I haven't really got any. But, Larry, what I do is just write it out in prose and then divide it up in lines. Long time ago, there was a cartoon. Some of you, there's not very many people in the audience out there old enough to remember. The man's dead now, I believe. There was a fellow named Williams who did a little box in the Scripps Howard papers called Out Our Way and Born 30 Years Too Soon, and a number of other really quite wonderful Americana cartoons. And part of them were about a shop. All these old-time working stiffs in a shop and what they do, what they say to one another. And one in this series was a house painter. And he was mixing up the paint. He had linseed oil, turpentine paint. He was stirring it up houses up here. And the householder, who was strictly a Casper milk toast, but you could see by the expression on his face, as they say, that he was very anxious to learn something about house painting so that the next time around he could save himself some money. And he says to the painter, excuse me, mister, but what is that you're putting on the paint that you're going to put on the door? And the painter says, muriatic acid. It makes the paint stick better. by and large, what you learn about poetry from poets, if they're bona fide articles, is what rubs off. Some years ago, I was back east reading, lecturing around a number of universities, and Lou Bogan was making the same circuit in upstate New York. In case you don't know who she is, a very fine poetess, one of the very best in America, and the poetry editor of The New Yorker, and one of the book critics of The New Yorker, and a middle-aged woman of considerable substance in every sense. She'll be out here. You want to all go and hear her because she's a really very, very excellent poet. And Lou was at Syracuse, had a class. So all these students were sitting around looking, first day, and they said, Miss Bogan, they called her, Miss Bogan, do you think you'll be able to produce some real poets out of this class? And Lou said, why, certainly not. If you want to be a poet, the place you belong is down in the Minetta Bar in Greenwich Village. Not spread all over the Eastern academic world. Did you hear what Lou Bogan said at Syracuse? Well, of course, what happens with a person like that is, as I say, it rubs off. I mean, the main way in which knowledge and skill and sympathy, so to speak, that is the creation of a like kind of vibration in the young is imparted, is by direct contact, not by theoretical literary analysis, although, of course, that has its place. And one of the purposes of the Poetry Center is to create, of course, to as large a degree as possible, that kind of living contact. And I hope that in the years to come, it increases. I hope that we get poets out here, part of the faculty of the school, and who'll rub you all real good so that it'll rub off on you. I hope that we don't get people who have it all charted out in the 37 kinds of ambiguity with diagrams. So I'm going to read some, first, a couple of poems from Chinese. I see all these people with the 37 kinds of ambiguity don't like me at all. I'm a terrible guy. And I really am the fellow that writes like the great Greeks and Romans. I mean, I may not write very well, but that's the way I write. They write like some minor Jacobean don at Cambridge, about 1630. Nobody ever heard of, unless he had a PhD from Heidelberg. So I decided, well, I'm going to fool you guys. So I'm bringing out 100 Chinese poems. Of course, this isn't really the reason I wrote this book. Bringing out 100 Chinese poems, 100 poems of the Greek and Latin, 100 French poems, 100 Japanese poems. That'll be out pretty soon. And 30 Spanish poems. I'm not like Bill. I'm not going to hide my light under a bushel. Anyway, what happened was that I didn't have a great deal to do. I mean, the spirit of genius was not blowing hard through my veins or the interstices of my head. And the thing to do when you feel like that is translate. Even old Ez says that the way you keep your hand in it is translation. I can't find what I want to know. This is by the Chinese poet Su Tung Po, and it's called At Gold Hill Monastery. My native land is up there far away near the head of the river. Just a wandering bureaucrat, I have been sent to the spot where the river enters the sea. I have heard that here, 10 feet deep in the salt marsh, you can find traces of the sand still cold, which bubbled up in the Zhongling Spring high in the rocky plateau by the southern trail. I have come here following the currents and waves. Now high in the tower, I overlook the whole countryside. South of the river, north of the river, the blue mountains are without number. The beauty of the evening cannot overcome my sorrow. I re-enter my rowboat to return. The monks in their lonely monastery sit watching the setting sun. The gentle breeze over 10,000 acres makes a fine brocade of the waters. In the last rays of the twilight, the schools of fish flicker in the water. At this moment, out of the river, the material soul of the moon is born. Later, after the second watch, after the moon has set, the heavens are left in profound blackness. Then in the heart of the river, the basket torches of the fishermen gleam. Their lights come and go, shining against the sky and frightening the birds asleep on the water. I try to sleep, but my heart is troubled, my mind is distracted. Neither men nor ghosts come here. What is it then? Has the spirit of the river shown me a vision to warn me? Since the river mouth and the islands affect me so, I will not come again to this monastery. I thank the spirit of the river, but what good has it done? Just as its waters cannot return to their source, so I can never return to my native land. This is by Ma Yao Chen, who was the Secretary of State in Sung China, roughly contemporary with Su Tung Po. And imagine John Foster Dulles writing this poem, and you can see the difference between Chinese Sung civilization. A friend advises me to stop drinking. In my young days, I drank a lot of wine. There's nothing wrong with the love of drink. Now I am old, and my teeth and hairs are few and far between. I still love to drink, but I can't do it like I used to. Now when I drink, it upsets my stomach. There's not much pleasure in it. Today I got drunk and couldn't hold up my head. The room turned round and round. Seeking pleasure, I find only sickness. This is certainly not the way to care for my health. Maybe I should give it up altogether. I'm afraid people will laugh at me. Still, you say it'd be a good idea. There's not much pleasure in a sour stomach and a bad breath. I really know that I ought to stop. If I don't do it, I don't know what'll happen to me. This is another by Ma. I remember the blue river. The moon has a halo, there will be a wind. The boatmen talk together in the night. Dawn, a brisk wind fills our sail. We leave the bank and speed over the white waves. It is no use for me to be here, back here in the land of Wu. My dream and my desire are back in Chao. I dreamt that one day she would come with me on a trip like this. Now she is only dust. Last, I'll read one or two poems of some of the women poets of the Sung Dynasty, the first women poets except one, who was more a historian than a poet, to play much of a role in Chinese literature and still the best. But before that, it occurs to me, I'll read. I can't find it. Yes, here it is. I'll read one by Liu Yi, who is one of the three or four best poets of the Song Dynasty. These translations, incidentally, are all of things that have never been in English, except for a considerable number by Du Fu, the Tang poet, who I'm not going to read. But all this Song stuff has never been translated. This is called "I Walk Out Into the Country at Night. The moon is so high it is almost in the Great Bear. I walk out of the city along the road to the west. The damp wind ruffles my coat. Dewy grass soaks my sandals. Fishermen are singing on the distant river. Foxfires dance on the ruined tombs. A chill wind rises and fills me with melancholy. I try to think of words that will capture the uncanny solitude. I come home late. The night is half spent. I stand for a long while in the doorway. My young son is still up reading. Suddenly he bursts out laughing, and all the sadness of the twilight of my life is gone." I think got rearranged since I last saw them. I can't find what I'm going to read. I think I'll read fairly long French poem by a poet who is quite popular in France, in fact, very popular, and who is unknown out of the country. There's a sort of French literature which is not for export, and then there's sort of export literature like Jean Cocteau or André Breton. This isn't very modern, but it's by Francis Carcot, Lambre. Somebody called it the Cimetière Marin of Montmartre. Cimetière Marin is the great quasi or pseudo philosophical poem, the life testimony of Paul Valéry. Carcot is a writer of the, what they call the milieu, of the Paris underworld. He's written a good many novels, and also a lot of songs which you can get by on records. There's an album or an LP of songs by Carcot, sung by Piaf, for instance. And this is sort of the summation of his life. Then I think I'll read my own poem. It's called "The Shadow" by Francis Carcot. "When I waited for you in the bar that night amongst the drunks who snickered when they tried to laugh, it seemed to me that you came late and that somebody followed you in the street. I saw you look around before you came in. You were afraid. You closed the door. And your shadow stayed outside. It was that which had followed you. Your shadow is always in the street, near the bar where I waited for you so often. But you are dead. And your shadow ever since is in the doorway. And wherever I go now, it follows me, fearfully like a beast. If I stop, it stops. If I speak to it, it runs away. Your shadow is the color of rain, of my regrets, of time which passes. It may disappear and hide itself, but when night comes, it is everywhere. At the subway station La Chapelle, in the poor and clamorous slums, it waits for me behind the black pillars, where other fraternal shadows wave to the passers-by and call with great gestures of hopelessness. But the passers-by never turn around. No one has ever known why in the wind which makes the street lamps blink, in the cold wind full of mystery, suddenly they quicken their steps. And me who seeks where you might be, me who knows that you wait for me there, I pass without recognizing you. I come and go all night, I walk alone just like in the old days, and your shadow the color of rain driven at each step by the wind, your shadow is lost in the night, but I feel it all around me. When you were just a streetwalker, just an innocent prostitute, like the girl who appeared in Whitechapel one night to Thomas De Quincey, and whom he sought too late and never found, from doorway to doorway and hotel to hotel, as he tells in a book. It was there for the first time that I met you. You were tired and sad like the tarts of London.
your hair still held an odor of fog. And while they stood you drinks, the drunken longshoremen insulted you or went home with you in the somber streets. I never forgot the effect which you had on me in that hopeless book, nor the wind, nor the rain, nor the gleaming pavement, nor the murderers of the night, nor the flares of the coffee stalls, nor the eddies of the Thames between its dismal embankments. And now, after all these years, another who resembles you comes along the gray buildings, beckons to me, and accosts me. It is not you. It is everything which you call back to me, as I was sad before I knew you, as I sank down with pleasure in my sorrow, walking the streets, going into the bars, begging the shadows of the night to speak to me, wandering on and on without stopping, but everywhere it was too late. The music of an accordion breaks off with a cough. They take down the lights one after another. A passerby from whom I ask a light holds out to me a dead cigar. Wherever I turn my steps, it is the same story. I am always going toward the train whistles on a great boulevard troubled and peopled with ghosts. There I wait for I do not know who, I do not know why, but the trains pass screaming, and this waiting is more like leaving. You have come to go away. I have brought you to these desolate places, and you have said to me, whatever you do, it is me. From now on, you will see among all these ghosts. You will feel me near you. You will think that I am dead, and you will never forget me. I listened to you and followed you under the street lights. There was no one but us alive where we went, only us, but I knew that of the two of us, the first to say goodbye would be you. There is no use trying to hold you by your little hand. The cries, the rumbling, the smoke of the trains, the rails and their signal lights, the black bridge all resounding, the noise of the heavy boxcars bumping each other by an obscure foreboding have already separated us. Another time in the same sinister district, we seat ourselves on a bench in the night, and the wind which drives the rain, the lamps of the rooming houses, the pimps in their damp sweaters, the girls who stare at us, gather around us, their witches' circle draws in on us. Then you are put to tears, trying to explain to me without raising your voice that one day you will deliver me from these ghosts which are in me. You talk and the rain falls. It is the rain which makes you weep, with a grief which nothing can appease, with an inconsolable pain. And the round of shadows and of the lights of houses revolves tirelessly, with the guys and their girls, the bars where the jukeboxes grind, flinging to us sometimes through the door the call of a dead voice. The round which nothing can stop turns and carries me with it, with you who are dead, turns and will carry me always, with all my past out of time, out of the world, out of all that is or is not, as you in the shadow you know. That for the French. Now we'll have some Rexroth. The first I'm going to read you are everything I'm reading is from unpublished material. I've got a lot of books, which are probably in the library, I hope. If somebody has stolen them, and you can read them there. But everything that I'm doing is unpublished. The Chinese poems will be out next year, I guess. The poem which I just read will be in the next New Directions annual, which will be a pocketbook published by Evergreen. And this book will be out, I hope, next year. And these are my own poems. The first are a series of poems to my little daughter, and they are called Astronomy Lessons, and they have the epigraph as a title of a book of science fiction by Frederick Brown called, I think, one of the most beautiful titles I ever saw. The book isn't so much. The Lights in the Sky Are Stars. And the book is called In Defense, the general book will be called In Defense of the Earth. One, Halley's Comet. When in your middle years the great comet comes again, remember me, a child, awake in the summer night, standing in my crib and watching that long-haired star so many years ago. Go out in the dark and see its plume over water, dribbling on the liquid night, and think that life and glory flickered on the rushing bloodstream for me once, and for all who have gone before me, vessels of the billion-year-long river that flows now in your veins. Halley's Comet, in case you haven't minded your lessons, comes once every, 97 years? Two, the great nebula of Andromeda. We get into camp after dark, high on an open ridge, looking out over 5,000 feet of mountains and mile beyond mile of valley and sea. In the star-filled dark, we cook our macaroni and eat by lantern light. Stars cluster around our table like fireflies. After supper, we go straight to bed. The night is windy and clear. The moon is 3 days short of full. We lie in bed and watch the stars and the turning moon through our little telescope. Late at night, the horses stumble around camp and I awake. I lie on my elbow watching your beautiful sleeping face like a jewel in the moonlight. If you are lucky and the nations let you, you will live far into the 21st century. I pick up the glass and watch the great nebula of Andromeda swim like a phosphorescent amoeba slowly around the pole. Far away in distant cities, fat-hearted men are planning to murder you while you sleep. Three, the heart of Heracles. In the constellation of Hercules, in case you don't know, there is a cluster of stars, and there's another poem about that in Cancer, in the Crab. Not a nebula, but a very dense cluster of stars, which you can see with the naked eye as a little spot, but which under a very weak glass shows up as a very splendid, dense ball of points of light. In Hercules, most of them Hercules are different colors, and in Cancer, they're mostly rather golden color. They say nowadays that you can't refer to the simplest episodes in the Bible or in classical mythology before an audience of students with any guarantee that anybody will know what you mean. I don't believe that, but I think that by and large people know who David and Moses were and Jesus Christ. But the finer details of astronomy may escape a miscellaneous audience, whether students or not, which is why I paused. I don't mean to insult your intelligence. Three, the heart of Heracles. Lying under the stars in the summer night late while the autumn constellations climb the sky, as the cluster of Hercules falls down the west, I put the telescope by and watch Deneb move toward the zenith. My body is asleep. Only my eyes and brain are awake. The stars stand around me like gold eyes. I can no longer tell where I begin and leave off. The faint breeze and the dark pines and the invisible grass, the tipping earth, the swarming stars, have an eye that sees itself. Four, a maze of sparks of gold. Spring, the rain goes by, the stars shine pale beside the Easter moon. Scudding clouds, tossing leaves whirl overhead. Blossoms fall in the dark from the fragrant madronia trees. You lie beside me, luminous and still in sleep. Overhead, bees sleep in their tree. Beyond them, the bees and the beehive and the crab drift slowly past, a maze of points of fire. I've had 10 times your years. Time holds us both fixed fast under the bright, wasting stars. A sword in a cloud of light. Your hand and mine, we walk out to watch the Christmas Eve crowds on Fillmore Street, the Negro district. The night is thick with frost. The people hurry, wreathed in their smoky breaths. Before the shop windows, the children jump up and down with spangled eyes. Santa Claus's ring bells, cars stall and honk. Streetcars clang. Loudspeakers on the lampposts sing carols. On jukeboxes in the bars, Louis Armstrong plays White Christmas. In the joints, the girls strip and grind and bump to Jingle Bells. Overhead, they do. Haven't you ever been to the bar at Christmas? Overhead, the neon signs scribble and erase and scribble again, messages of avarice, joy, fear, hygiene, and the proud names of the middle classes. The moon beams like a pudding. We stop at the main corner and look up diagonally across at the rising moon and the solemn, orderly, vast winter constellations. You say, there's Orion. The most beautiful object either of us will ever know in the world or in life stands in the moonlit empty heavens over the swarming men, women, and children, black and white, joyous and greedy, evil and good, buyer and seller, master and victim, like some immense theorem which, if once solved, would forever solve the mystery and pain under the bells and spangles. There he is, the man of the night before Christmas, spread out on the sky like a true god, in whom it is would be only necessary to believe a little. I am 50 and you are 5. It would do me no good to say this, and it may do no good to write it. Believe in Orion. Believe in the night, the moon, the crowded earth. Believe in Christmas and birthdays and Easter rabbits. Believe in all those fugitive compounds of nature, all doomed to waste away and go out. Always be true to these things. They are all there is. Never give up this savage religion for the blood-drenched civilized abstractions of the rascals who live by killing you and me. Blood on a Dead World. I write about other things besides astronomy. I thought I'd read you this series, which has a unity, and you can see, to talk like Mr. Empson, how a very limited thematic material is subjected to variation, both verbal and in meaning and in metrics. Different ambiguities are brought out. Sidereal universe, you see, poem by poem. Blood on a Dead World. A blowing night in late fall, the moon rises with a nick in it. All day, Mary has been talking about the eclipse. Every once in a while, I go out and report on the progress of the Earth's shadow. When it is passing the half, Martha and Mary come out and we stand on the corner in the first wisps of chilling fog and watch the light go out. Streamers of fog reach the moon, but never quite cover it. We have explained with an orange, a grapefruit, and a lamp. Not that we expect a child, a four-year-old child, to understand, but just as a sort of ritual duty. But we are surprised. I tell her the Indians called an eclipse blood on the moon. Is it all the blood on the earth makes the shadow that color, she asks. I do not answer. From Martha. In mid-March, in the heart of the night, in the center of the sterile city, in the midst of miles of asphalt and stone, alone and frustrated, wakeful on my narrow bed, my brain spinning with worry, there came to me, slipping through the interstices of the night, of the blowing darkness, the living, almost imperceptible, faint, persistent, recurrent song of a single tree toad, a voice sweeter than most birds. 7 years ago, we lay naked and moist, making love under the Easter full moon, the thick, fragrant light shaking with the songs of mockingbirds. I guess that's what Ruth meant about these shocking things I talk about. I wish I had some other shockers in here. I don't know. Here's a series called A Bestiary. I'll read some of them. For my daughters, Mary and Catherine. Aardvark. The man who found the aardvark was laughed out of the meeting of the Dutch Academy. Nobody would believe him. The aardvark had its revenge. It returned in dreams, in smoke, in anonymous letters. One day somebody found out it was in Hieronymus Bosch all the time. From there it had sneaked off to Africa. How much time have I got? What time is it? Ant. Achilles, Aesop, Mark Twain, Stalin, all studied the ant. Your odds are 1 to 3 if you decide to ignore it. The aardvark, he eats them up and scares all the people. Bear. When the world is white with snow, the bear sleeps in his darkness. When the people are asleep, the bear comes with glowing eyes and steals their bacon and eggs. He can follow the bees from point to point for their honey. The bees sting, but he never pays them any mind. Tame bears in zoos beg for buns. Two philosophies of life. Honey is better for you than buns. But zoo tricks are cute and make everybody laugh. Cat. There are too many poems about cats. Beware of cat lovers. They have a hidden frustration somewhere and will stick you with it if they can. They sneak up on you, you watch. Coney. Conies are a feeble folk, but their home is in the rocks. If you've only got one rock, there are better things to do with it than make a home of it. Cow. The contented cow gives milk. When they come to ask, do you give milk, as they surely will, say no. Deer. Deer are gentle and graceful. They have beautiful eyes. They hurt no one but themselves, the males, and only for love. Men have invented several thousand ways of killing them. Eagle. The eagle is very proud. He stays alone by himself up in the top of the sky. Only brave men find his home. Few telescopes are sharper than his eyes. I think it's fine to be proud, but remember that all the rest goes with it. There is another kind of eagle on flags and money. Fox. The fox is very clever. In England, people dress up like a movie star's servants and chase the fox on horses. Rather, they let dogs chase him, and they come along behind. When the dogs have torn the fox to pieces, they rub his blood on the faces of young girls. If you are clever, do not let anybody know it, but especially Englishmen. Goat. G stands for goat, and also for genius. If you are one, learn from the other, for he combines domestication, venery, and independence. Herring. The herring is prolific. There are plenty of herrings. Some herrings are eaten raw. Many are dried and pickled, but most are used for manure. See if you can apply this to your history lesson. Horse. It's fun to ride the horse. If you give him some sugar, he will love you. But even the best horses kick sometimes. A rag blowing in the wind can cause him to kill you. These characteristics he shares with the body politic. I. Take care of this. It's all there is. You'll never get another. Jackal. The jackal's name is often used as a term of contempt. This is because he follows the lion around and lives on the leavings of his kill. Lions terrify most men who buy meat at the butcher's. Kangaroo. As you know, the kangaroo has a pocket, but all she puts in it is her baby. Never keep a purse if all you can find to put in it is additional expense. The reception of these words will also serve to warn you. Never make fun of babies. Lion. The lion is called the king of beasts. Nowadays, there are almost as many lions in cages as out of them. If offered a crown, refuse. Monkey. Monkeys are our relatives. On observing their habits, some are ashamed of monkeys, some deny the relation. Some are ashamed of themselves. They throw coconuts at us. Man. Someday, if you are lucky, you'll each have one for your own. Try it before you pick it. Some kinds are made of soybeans. Give it lots to eat and sleep, treat it nicely, and it will always do just what you want. Mantis. In South Africa, among the Bushmen, the mantis is a god, a predatory and cannibalistic bug, but one of the nicer gods. N. N is for nothing. There is much more of it than something. A possum. When in danger, the possum plays dead. The state, when dying, plays danger. With the possum, this trick even works. Sometimes he escapes. But when the state plays with death, it really dies. Okapi. The okapi is extinct. The reason is under N. Quagga. If it weren't for the quagga, we'd be short of a beast for Q. I can't think of one, can you? Raccoon. The raccoon wears a black mask, and he washes everything before he eats it. If you give him a cube of sugar, he'll wash it away and weep. Some of life's sweetest pleasures can be enjoyed only if you don't mind a little dirt, and here a false face won't help you. Seal. The seal, when in the water, is a slippery customer to catch, but when he makes love, he goes on dry land, and men kill him with clubs. To have a happy love life, control your environment. Guess this has gone over. Trout. The trout is taken when he bites an artificial fly. Confronted with fraud, keep your mouth shut and don't volunteer. Unicorn. The unicorn is supposed to seek a virgin, lay his head in her lap and weep, whereupon she steals his horn. Virginity is what is known as a privation. It is very difficult to find any justification for something that doesn't exist. However, in your young days, you might meet a unicorn. There are not many better things than a unicorn horn. Uncle Sam. Like the unicorn, Uncle Sam is what is called a myth. Plato once wrote a book, which is an occult conspiracy of gentlemen pederasts. In it, he said that ideas are more nobly real than reality and that myths help keep people in their place. Since you will never become, under any circumstances, gentleman pederasts, you'd best leave these blood-soaked notions to those who find them useful. Wolf, never believe all you hear. Wolves are not as bad as lambs. I've been a wolf all my life and have two lovely daughters to show for it. While I could tell you sickening tales of lambs who got their just desserts. Scarecrow. A hex was put on you at birth. Society certified your existence and claimed you as a citizen. Don't let it scare you. Learn to cope with a world which is built entirely of fraud and in which, if you find a truth instead of a lie, it is due to somebody's oversight. These stuffed old rags are harmless unless you show them the fear which they can never warrant or reveal the contempt which, of course, is all they deserve. If you do, they'll come to life and do their best to kill you. Let Y stand for you, who says, very clever, but surely these were not written for your children. Let Y stand for yes. Zebra. Clothes do not make the zebra. Better wear a convict's stripes, free on the lonely savannah, than the panoplied harness of a queen in Rotten Row or a thief's colors at Ascot. Still got a minute? The mirror in the woods. I wish I had some more sexy ones, but I didn't write any. A mirror hung on the broken walls of an old summer house deep in the dark woods. Nothing ever moved in it but the undersea shadow of ferns, rhododendrons, and redwoods. Moss covered the frame. One day the gold and glue gave way and the mirror slipped to the floor. For many more years it stood on the shattered boards. Once in a long time a wood rat would pass it by without ever looking in. At last we came, breaking the sagging door and letting in a narrow wedge of sunlight. We took the mirror away and hung it in my daughter's room with a bar before it. Now it reflects Rons, Eckharts, Relevés, and Arabesques. In the old house, the shadows, the wood rats, and the moss work unseen. Now I'll try to find this Chinese lady who was sexy enough for both of us in a nice Chinese way. And I'll read a couple of those poems and then I'll stop. Hysteria. When I look in the mirror, my face frightens me. I am afraid of myself. Every spring, weakness overcomes me like a mortal sickness. I am too weary to arrange the flowers or paint my face. Everything bothers me. All the old sorrows flood back and make the present worse. The crying nightjars terrify me. The mating swallows embarrass me, flying two by two outside my window. plucked eyebrows, weary eyes that have grown hard with loneliness. Swallows chirp in the painted eaves, but I have lost the ability to even dream of happiness. Each new spring finds me deeper, tangled and snarled in bitterness. As all the world grows more lovely, my bowels are torn with sorrow. Peach blossoms quiver in the light of the new moon on the first nights of the season of cold food. High willows in the golden twilight wave their long shadows in the clear, bright winds of spring. Surrounded by flowers, trapped in pain, I watch the sun set behind the roofs of the woman's quarters. Spring. This, incidentally, I didn't say. The woman's name is Chu Jiao Chen. She was a Sung Dynasty poetess. Spring. Spring has come. I try to forget all the old quarrels and anguish. In the gentle breeze and the clear brightness, all things should start anew. But why do the birds all hate me? Why do the flowers betray me? Why do the peach and cherry blossoms prostrate me? Tears streak the paint on my cheeks. My girdle is too loose for my starved body. When spring comes with a third moon, I know I am a burden to my Lord. But, oh, my Lord, in this third moon of spring, the east wind is a heavy burden to me. And this is another Chinese poetess, Li Xing Chao, roughly a contemporary. She lived a little earlier, I think. Mist. In my narrow room, I throw wide the window and let in the profound lasciviousness of spring. Confused shadows flicker on the half-drawn curtains. Hidden in the pavilion, wordlessly, I strum the rose jade harp. Far away, a rocky cliff falls from the mountain in the early twilight. A gentle breeze blows the mist like a shadow across my curtain. Oh, bright pods of the pepper plant, you do not need to bow and beg pardon. I know that you cannot hold back the passing day. The day of cold food. This is a day in which all fires are started over in China in the early spring, somewhat similar to Holy Saturday in Roman Catholic countries. It's an almost universal festival of new fire is what it really is. And, of course, the food is cold because there's no fire to cook it. The day of cold food. Clear and bright is the splendor of spring on the day of cold food. The dying smoke rises from the jade animal like a silk thread floating in water. I dream on a pile of cushions amongst scattered and broken hair ornaments. The swallows have not come back from the southern sea, but already men begin again, fighting for straws. Petals fly from the peach trees along the river. Willow catkins fill the air with floss. Then, in the orange twilight, fall widely spaced drops of rain. Thank you.